Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and thank you for joining us. We have a busy hour ahead. Let's jump right into it. Our schools need more teachers. There's a shortage of classroom talent that precedes the coronavirus, but has only been made more serious by the pandemic. It's Cynthia Reeser's focus and the latest in her Eastern Standard series on public education. Her guest, Dr. Amanda Ellis, Associate Vice President of K-12 Programs and Policies at the Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education.
Dr. Ellis is here to discuss a report that was released earlier this year about a growing shortage, of teachers, school administrators, and school counselors in Kentucky. So according to this new report, in what grade certification areas are we seeing the most educator shortages?
Yeah, so the study that the Council on Postsecondary did with an organization called ENSI really looked at the different grade bands. The data that they were able to pull didn't get content specific, although that is available through the Kentucky Department of Education. And surprisingly, what bubbled up is going to be the greatest need, believe it or not, is elementary teachers. It shows you, honestly, where we're headed as far as shortages go and why it's important to elevate the teaching profession. Of course, we always have shortage areas in secondary mathematics and science, and often special education as well. But we're also seeing an increasing need, which to me is a bit encouraging, for preschool teachers, certified early childhood preschool teachers. And as you know, in the state of Kentucky and within the nation, there's been a heavy emphasis on the importance of early childhood and quality care. And I think more people are really starting to look at brain development and the need for high quality early care and early education.
You know, that's surprising because for years there's really been a surplus in elementary teachers. So the tide is really turning there.
That's exactly right. And I will be honest and tell you, when we first saw the results, we really questioned it because the criticism in the past, to your point, has been that we have entirely too many elementary teachers. But I really think it speaks to the need for us to look at a long-term trajectory on where our teaching profession is going and meeting the demand, the supply meeting the demand. And so to me, it really caught my attention that if it is truly elementary teachers, and that's been our area of criticism, we have work to do to increase our supply. But You're absolutely right.
Your report also divides the educator workforce into regions of the state. So what regions in Kentucky are we seeing the most need, and how can we address that problem?
That's a great question. So we have a few different regional needs. So as you stated, we do report out critical shortage in Kentucky by workforce regions because there are specific needs. Clearly in our Eastern Kentucky regions that are much more rural and doesn't have a lot of growth or things that pull folks into those rural, poor areas, it's harder to not only recruit, but also retain those teachers, especially in math and science. But if you talk to our colleagues in Jefferson County, they would say that they have some of the very same issues in urban areas with high poverty, high minority, and then there's a high turnover rate in some of the more at-risk schools. And so in each of our regions, quite honestly, there's always a little bit of need in different areas. So our rural areas tend to really struggle to recruit folks into those small communities. But the retainment piece is really just as challenging, no matter if it's urban or rural.
And, you know, you brought this up, that the problem isn't always getting the new teachers and administrators, but it's retaining them. And studies for years have shown that new teachers often leave the field in their first 3 to 5 years, and the turnover rates in some schools can be exceptionally high. So why is it important to have experienced teachers and administrators, and what can we do to retain them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think Kentucky in the past has had a really good program in place. And I think local districts, not all, but really make efforts around retention. So to your point, as anyone knows who's gone into the teaching field, it is a lifestyle and it is not for the faint at heart. It's very difficult. It's challenging, highly rewarding. But coming into a new career and being put in charge of multiple students and needs really requires great mentoring and support in those first few years, and to really help establish who those teachers are in their profession. And so the importance of retention really must be strategic from the very beginning to ensure that there's wraparound support for these new teachers, to ensure that they understand what's available to them, resources, and growing their skill set. And so, as you know, we used to have the program KTIP, Kentucky Teacher Internship Program. There is also one for principals as well, and it has not been funded for the last several years. But it was beneficial because there were three people that provided support and feedback to a new teacher in that first year. And while it was not perfect by any means, it did provide support and intentional guidance to those new teachers to help them succeed and to really promote retention and to get them established. And I feel like many districts are trying to maintain that, and they didn't really realize what a good partnership it was with the universities, I think, until it wasn't available. But it did show in the past to be beneficial for Kentucky, and hopefully in the near future, maybe there can be additional strategies. But we definitely see that as a need. And that's not just for teachers, but also, to your point, school leaders as well.
You know, I started my career when KTIP first started. So I've been a new teacher with KTIP. And then much later, I've served on KTIP committees as a university person. And it does provide a lot of feedback, a lot of support. And no matter how well prepared a first-year teacher is in the program that prepared them, there's still a lot to learn that first year. And
that's
and
right.
You make the point. You need help that first and even second year to really become the best teacher you can be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, I had the opportunity as a former elementary principal and a curriculum resource teacher to serve in the coaching role and the administrator role. And, you know, not only did I feel like we helped grow capacity of our new teachers and keep them, we had less turnover, but it also helped me as an administrator or curriculum coach to know where the needs were when they came in and the skills that needed to be developed to provide that intentional professional learning support and to target certain areas of growth in our school. And so it was extremely beneficial, not just for the new teacher, but I think for the school community as well.
I think so, because an experienced teacher works with that new teacher, someone
right.
from the university, and an administrator.
That's exactly right. And all bring very different perspectives to the table, which is a welcome conversation.
It is. In this series of interviews, we also talked with Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman about relaunching and funding the Kentucky Academy for Equity in Teaching. And this program is focused on recruiting and retaining teachers of color. What did your study learn about diversity in the education workforce in Kentucky?
It's a great question, and we are so appreciative of Lieutenant Governor Coleman's commitment and Governor Beshear's commitment to diversifying our teacher workforce. And in our study, we have had very little growth over the past several years. There is a longitudinal view of this from the past 20 years, and where we have gained over 1,000 new African-American teachers, it is still hanging right at about 4%. Of our total population. Hispanic teachers are even less, and Asian. And so we have work to do on really diversifying our teacher workforce to even come close to aligning to the diversity of our student body, which is a little over 8% in the state. But clearly, in different communities, it's a higher population. And so we are working collectively with the Education Workforce Development Cabinet and the Kentucky Department of Education to work together to implement strategies and really evaluate the effectiveness of those strategies. And we are grateful for the funding, but also really the support and the focus on the need for this to not only elevate our profession, but to diversify it to meet the unique needs of our students. And quite honestly, that is a great recruitment tool for many students who may consider education when they see others that look like them doing the job. That's highly important for students to be able to see that and experience different diverse backgrounds and perspectives and folks that teach them. And so that's really important to us, and we are grateful to be a part of that work.
Why is it important to have all teachers and administrators be culturally aware?
One of the things that we are held accountable for as educators that has been in our expectations and Danielson framework that is used at the state for teacher evaluation, but really that's been embedded in the fibers of what we are to do is to know and understand and appreciate the unique needs and cultural experiences and the communities in which our students come from so we can best meet their needs. If you look at our student performance data, while it's not the end all be all, it is a heck of a thermometer for us to really look and think about how we are addressing the individual and unique needs of our students and appreciating their backgrounds and the cultural differences. And part of that is building the capacity of our teachers to know and understand that and be aware of their own perceptions and their own biases. And we all have them, but not just in a negative tone, but very much being open to understanding our students at an individual level. And if you look at our gaps, we haven't done a great job of that, of really meeting the individual needs of our students when they come from different races or ethnicity or even socioeconomic status. It's not great. There's significant gaps. And so we have work to do on knowing and understanding the cultural differences of our students and how we best meet their needs to help them succeed.
That's a great point. You know, when I started teaching, I ended up going back to my hometown and I thought, oh, my students are all like me because I'm from here. And I was really wrong. And I learned that because they're, even though they may have looked like me,
because
it was not a diverse community, they weren't like me. They had been brought up in different kinds of homes, in different socioeconomic situations. Mm-hmm. And I had to learn the hard way how to address the needs of lots of students, even the ones that look like me and I assumed
that's
were
right.
like me and I was wrong. So that's really good that that you're looking at those strategies for future and current teachers.
Absolutely. And it's not easy, you know, because things change and students change in their needs. And I think being aware of that, and to your point, was an excellent point of just because they may look like me doesn't mean that they have the same belief system or they think like me or live like me. And so I think being aware and acknowledging and honoring those differences just help us to be stronger educators and really provide for those who we serve. So I think it is the right work. And we don't want this to be compliance work. We really want this to be thoughtful and to really change our behaviors and bring an awareness that really enhances how we better connect with our students and families.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. And hopefully more people will be inspired to be educators in the future.
I hope so. And I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Dwayne Lundy returns with the latest in his Depth of Field series and guest, Gil Holland, owner of The Group Entertainment in Louisville, which includes a film production company with more than 100 titles to its credit, a talent management division, a music company, and the Green Building Art Gallery.
Gil Holland, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Dwayne. Nice to be with you.
I want to start off by asking you the same question I've asked a couple of other guests who are creatives from Kentucky. Have you found it to be a hurdle or an asset?
You know, great question. I will say that I spent most of my 20s and 30s living in lots of places around the world, France and Spain and England, and my mom's from Norway, and I lived in New York, and I had a TV show. You know, I was in LA for a season. And then when I met my now wife, who's from Louisville, and started coming to Louisville, I was like, wow, this is a great town. Like, nobody really knows about Louisville, Kentucky. There's lots of challenges related to Kentucky from 100 years of Hollywood stereotyping. But Louisville is this like amazing town, low cost of entry for the creative class. So it's one of the most creative places I've ever, maybe the most creative place I've ever been in. And, you know, people can make their art and only have to maybe cater waiter one day a week instead of, you know, 80 hours a week.
Can you give us a little background in how you ended up in film and music?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was the guy who would, you know, make my roommates watch obscure black and white subtitled movies. But I never thought that that was actually a job you could have until I, having finished law school, which I figured was a good kind of placeholder, I moved to Paris and worked in a law firm in Paris. And one of the clients of the firm was this French film producer. And I just all of a sudden light bulbs started going off. I was like, wait a minute, he doesn't seem that smart. I've seen as many movies as he has. People make movies? I want to do that. So moved back to New York, started interning at age 29 with a law degree. People were like, what are you doing? And I'm like, you know, that's how you break in to these, you know, iceberg. I call them iceberg industries because, you know, everybody sees the 1%, the famous people who've made it. You know, nobody sees the 99% of people who are slogging away. I was like, that's how you got to break in, and I'm ready to do it. So I started interning, and one thing led to another.
So was the music side of things with Sonoblast, which I've had the great fortune of working with on a number of occasions, was that a adjunct idea that you were going to do separately, or was that definitely a wash and dry relationship between that and the film side of things?
It's actually kind of interesting. So when you make a movie, I mean, you know, like lots of people, I, you know, had dreams of being a professional soccer player or a rock star and, you know, hacked away on my Yamaha acoustic. And I was a DJ in college at WXYC, which is, you know, one of the best radio stations in the country. So I was always into music in a big way, and making movies, the last, like kind of the last creative input to a film is all the music you put in, right? You've shot the film, you've edited the film, and now you got to put in the music. And it turns out that clearing music for movies is really challenging often. You know, I was making my first movie. I'd gotten some of my friends in New York who were in, you know, unsigned bands. And I was like, look, the movie's going to be great exposure for you guys. And I had some experiences where the folks were not so keen on licensing their music after we'd already cut it into the movie. And then we're like, oh, we got to remix the whole film. And that cost, you know, $20,000. We got to take the song out, or we got to pay the, you know, pay what they want. So I was like, man, there's got to be a better way. And I had a show called Greg the Bunny on Fox for a season, which was with Sean Baker, and Eugene Levy played Gil in the show. And it was kind of a much heralded, but one season comedy. And instead of doing anything smart with the money that we made from the show, like, you know, buy a house or something, I started a music company. For me, it was being able to license easily music for film, as kind of a one-stop shop, being a service to these independent filmmakers. Because the other reality is, when you make an independent film, invariably you run out of money at the very end. And of course, at the very end is when you need the music. And if the music is terrible, you know, a movie can go from, you know, B minus to A with great music.
The thing I appreciated in the occasions that I had to work for you and with you was how artist friendly, creative friendly you were, and how nurturing towards the artist and the production team. Obviously, that comes a bit from your own creative side. And it makes me wonder, is that how you go about choosing projects, is predicated off of the amount of trust that you have in those artists?
First, I'll just say it was really a great moment of kismet that I lived in Kentucky, that I had met a young Ben Solee, that we had released his first record. I was working with this young woman filmmaker, documentarian, on the documentary Maiden Trip about the 13-year-old Dutch girl who became the youngest person ever to sail around the world solo. And, you know, I started thinking that, you know, a boat is basically, you know, a box of wood, and a cello is a box of wood. And maybe this guy who's never scored a movie would be the perfect person. And luckily, the main producer on Maiden Trip actually knew Ben Solee, not personally, but knew the music. It was like, oh, yeah, he's great. We like him. And I was like, well, let's see. Why don't you guys come down to, you know, Dwayne's place here in Lexington and meet with Ben. And, you know, we worked out a deal, and that score, you know, ended up getting on some, we don't even know how it got on some playlists and whatnot, but, you know, the score's done incredibly well. The film did amazingly well as well, won South by Southwest. So that was kind of a perfect, everything coming together, film, music, you know, love for Kentucky, bringing Kentucky culture to the world, really. And, you know, I think it's over 30 million streams, the various songs on that soundtrack. So, yeah, so that's been a big success. And then in terms of picking the movies, like, you know, obviously we could go to Hollywood and make popcorn, you know, alien movies and make tons of money. And that would be fun. And it's great entertainment. And, you know, every now and then I will do like a little genre film just for fun, like to give some people their first break into the film industry, or some actors who aren't SAG yet to, you know, star in a movie. But generally, we try to do films that have some kind of moral underpinnings, or, you know, save the world, or shine a light on something that's been underrepresented. So we do some documentaries, we do some features, and, you know, it's very hard to make a good movie at the end of the day, too, because you have all these creative people, and the director has a creative vision, and you're the producer, and you're trying to fulfill that vision. But sometimes, you know, somebody on the crew thinks they're making a slightly different movie. You know, if the director's not good enough at communicating the vision, you can have like 8 different creatives all making slightly different movies in their mind. And then, of course, the final product is not that great. So it's hard to make a great movie.
Years ago, there was a big push to bring film to Kentucky using the natural resources that we have here, the landscape, the city, the open spaces through tax incentives. Then it sort of seems to the interested outsiders such as myself that we hit a bit of a ceiling. Can you give me a little of your insight into sort of where that stands right now as far as Kentucky is related towards being able to profit a bit with its relationships to TV and film and advertising?
Well, under Steve Beshear, we did pass a very, I thought, a pretty responsible tax incentive for movies. Studied a bunch of the other states, the states that had done it wrong, that had given too much away. You want to incent things that are starting out, right? You shouldn't be always incentivizing stuff that's already established. But, you know, we don't have any studios here. We haven't had, you know, look at the boom in Nashville, Tennessee. I would argue a lot of that is because 8 to 10 million people are watching a TV show every week called Nashville. There's no real reason. I mean, maybe the lack of income tax, which has attracted some high level executives, but they just get you on property tax and sales tax. You know, those are the only two reasons I can see that Nashville has boomed so much, right? They've done a little bit of good branding with the music scene, but we have great creative potential in Kentucky. We can shoot most movies except for maybe a Wall Street scene or a beach scene, but we're starting back from scratch. You know, Governor Bevin kind of canceled the transferability of the tax credits, which basically meant it was worthless. So Governor Andy Beshear is bringing it back, but we're kind of starting back at zero. But, you know, there's Braden King made a great film up in Harlan County called The Evening Hour with a lot of Kentucky musicians, Kentucky actors, Kentucky crew. I just helped Izzy Schill and Felipe Diepa did a movie here in Louisville. And Izzy was like, you know, she lives in LA. She's like, it was the best crew I've ever worked with. So we just got to get the word out. And, you know, we kind of lost the 4 years under Bevin, and we're coming back though.
Having been in the industry for 25 plus years, you've seen a complete 180 degree turn with the way we listen, the way we watch, the way we participate, the way we pay, and in some ways don't pay. Do you have a particular positive view of what lies ahead for us, not only as somebody who's on the business side, but as a creative?
Yeah, well, it is actually a super exciting time to be a creative in both music and film. And, you know, when I started in the film business in the 90s, it was mainly upper white middle class dudes making movies because they could raise the money to rent the 35 millimeter camera and to pay for film and to pay for developing. So then with the advent of digital video, it's back to like pencil and paper. Anybody can make a movie, right? It's really just, do you have a story? Can you shoot it? Do you have some friends that can act in it? You know, but there's a great democratization of film. And then the great thing about music is, you know, again, it cost money back in the day to produce vinyl records and then to ship vinyl records. And then if they didn't sell in Peoria, they would get sent back to you. And, you know, your returns would eat away all your potential profits from the sales you did have. Whereas now, literally, like, we can record, get the masters, and literally submit the metadata, and a week later, and anybody can do this, they don't need a label. Like, anybody can have their music in, you know, 140 countries in a week. So now the challenge there is, like, how do you get then people to listen to your music? You know, there has been a hollowing out of the, just like in the economy, there's been a hollowing out of the middle class. Like, you know, the big names get all the spins, and the small names get very few spins, and you're working it. And, you know, in the old days, like, you know, Ben Solis' first record, we sold, I don't know, like 25,000 CDs at 10 bucks each, you know. And if you sold 10 CDs at a show, that's $100. That gets you to the next gig, helps pay for the hotel. You know, you go to a show, you're probably not selling anything, maybe a t-shirt, and maybe you get 1,000 streams on Spotify, and that's, you know, not worth anything. You know, 1 million streams on Spotify is about $4,000. And that's why the label exists, because we get a lot of placements and we do co-publishing deals with our artists. And so we're relying on the performance royalties from, you know, ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC to basically subsidize the label. You know, the label was started in the ashes of Napster, you know, 19 years ago, 2001, 2002. And, which is a good time to start a label, because there's only one way to go, and that's up. But, you know, we were starting the label and the publishing company at the same time, because we knew in some ways the label would really just be marketing for the publishing company.
Gil, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a thrill over the years to be able to work with you, and I know it's been a great inspiration for many artists to see you do what you do from Kentucky, and has given rise towards other artists feeling like that they can stay here and have a career.
Thanks, Dwayne. We'll see you soon.
I'm Dwayne Lundy with Depth of Field on Eastern Standard.
Coming up after the break, a Lexington rising star, what's on the bottoms of Kentucky's man-made lakes, and an update on our arts content partner, Undermate. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. The second Arts Connect Open Studios Weekend will take place in Lexington on October 23rd and 24th. Over 40 artists will open their studios to the public on those dates from 12 noon to 5 p.m. Visitors to the studios are encouraged to observe work in progress and to engage in conversation with the participating artists. Studio sales will offer collectors an opportunity to purchase work directly from the artists. The weekend begins with an opening reception on Friday, October 22nd at the Downtown Public Library Gallery, where an exhibition of work by the participating artists will run through November 21st. For more information about tickets to the Open Studios Weekend and about the participating artists, you can go to artsconnectlex.org. For in-depth writing about Kentucky and the region's arts and culture, go to undermain.art. Subscription to Undermain's arts newsletter can be found on the website. I'm Wendy Barnett, and this has been an Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Now, back to Tom Martin.
You probably heard of someone who does what they do as a labor of love. In other words, they do it because they believe in it, not with an expectation of profit. We're taking a moment to tell you about one such endeavor that has recently gone through some very significant changes. And full disclosure, I'm involved in this. During the break just now, Wendy Barnett told us about some upcoming arts events in the region based on information from our content partner, Undermain. Undermain is a 501c3 nonprofit and has been supported since its inception in 2014 by its trio of publishers, Christine Huskisson, Art Sheckett, and me, and editor Bobby Newman has joined us in recent years. Now, I've asked Christine Huskisson to join me for just a few minutes to fill you in on this arts resource that's at your disposal free of charge. Hi, Christine.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tell our listeners about that transition that I mentioned. Tell us what's been going on.
I think what's of interest right now is what's happened in the last couple of years. And it has been a rapid growth. And I think it's a rapid growth because our community of artists, consumers, and producers have all been growing. And we're now in the midst of a more discerning readership. And over the last 2 years, we have stepped up our game. And we realized we needed to grow the website in particular to make it a little bit more user-friendly, easy to navigate. Over the last 18 months, we have been working with a gentleman named Patrick King of House of Pretty in Chicago, Illinois. And it's been a pleasure working with Patrick. I know you realize this, Tom, but the content is now very rich, very deep, very professional. You can find music interviews. You can find in-depth interviews of arts-related administrators, performing arts goings-on, There's also now an arts calendar, thank you to our partnership with Infinite Industries, and even the recognition of some of our community partners and funders on the website itself. And it's all very clear and laid out in a nice, clean fashion. Overall, I think this was done in support of us trying to present a platform for the higher quality content that we now have.
And that's been made possible by a really significant grant from the Great Meadows Foundation. Tell our listeners about that.
Yes, it has. The Great Meadows Foundation came on board with us in 2019. The funding has grown through 2020 through 2021, and the new funding, very exciting news, expands what was restricted to visual arts and Kentucky only, now to a larger region. We now have funding from the Great Meadows Foundation to move into the Midwest region and the Upper South. We are offering travel stipends, in fact, to writers to go to places like Cleveland, Chicago, St. Louis, Nashville, Knoxville. And we're interested in knowing if you're out there, if you're a writer and you want to travel, you can please contact us at publishers@undermain.art.
Yeah, sounds good. And also, we just received a grant from Kentucky Arts Council, and we have yet to kind of suss out how that's going to be applied, but we're working on that and very excited about it. Also, mention the newsletter that we have going.
Yes, without a doubt. On the website, there's now easy access to that. If you just check out the very top nav bar on the website, you can access and hopefully sign up for the newsletter. It's something that Art Sheckett, our eloquent but never too verbose partner, puts together all the time. It is our, we're moving in this direction. We would prefer to communicate with our audience, with our readership, through the newsletter as opposed to some of the more controversial social media apps.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Undermain produces this annual event that you're very much involved in. It's called Critical Mass. It was sidelined because of the pandemic, but we're returning October 30th with another event. Tell us about its purpose and what to expect if we attend this fifth annual Critical Mass.
Critical Mass is now in its fifth year, and it will be taking place this year, October 30th, from 9:30 to 11, with a 30-minute question-answer afterwards. It is free. However, we accept donations if you would please do that. If you go to undermain.art, you can click on the link to register. That's all we ask that you do so that we know how many people are participating. It is Zoom-based, and it will be featuring Esther Callahan, who is an independent curator, arts organizer, and feminist scholar, very interested in how curators manage their privilege, if you will, their power, and understand that they could cause harm if not done so discerningly.
So interesting. Christine Huskisson, she's a co-publisher with me, with Art Sheckett, for undermain.art, and you can find it online. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
From growing up and going to school in Lexington to senior editor on the special projects team at The Atlantic, that's Janisha Watts, Gerald Smith's guest in his series on racial justice and equality.
Janisha is a Lexington native and a graduate of Bryan Station High School and the University of Kentucky School of Journalism. She also holds a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University. Janisha has been a freelance writer at Essence Magazine and held editorial positions at Time Books and People's Magazine. She's been a features and commentary editor for ESPNW and edited pieces for ESPN, the magazine. She was formerly the general editor for The Culture of the Undefeated. Watts is working on her first biography, You Cannot Slot Me, The Life and Words of Charles Stevenson Wright. Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, describes Ms. Watts as a brilliant editor and a creative thinker with a deep Atlantic sensibility. We have all been struck by the quality of her ideas, by the originality of her thinking, by her infectious curiosity, and by her ambition. Welcome, Ms. Watts, to this segment on racial justice and equality. And, I'd like to just sort of begin our segment by asking a few questions, and the first being, how did you become interested in journalism?
First, thank you for having me. And the question is, so how did I become interested in journalism? The more I think about it, I know as a kid, my mom would read Curious George, the book. And I didn't connect it until maybe about, actually until like a couple years later, that I think having that curiosity as a kid. And then when I attended high school, I landed on wanting to be a journalist. So I think high school was the time when I decided I wanted to be working in media and edit stories and write for different publications.
Okay. And so what has that experience been like over the years? You've seen journalism change in the past 10 or 15 years, particularly with all that's happened in the national news. What have you noticed?
One big thing I've noticed is the impact of social media and how it's allowed or given journalists more opportunities to work either directly with editors and also opportunities to bring ideas to legacy publications. Mm-hmm. So I'll say that what's changed a lot is just the landscape of it, the opportunities for younger journalists to have a seat at the table earlier than later.
So now you have recently been appointed as a senior editor for special projects for The Atlantic. And this is a major publication, a great opportunity for you as you bring a wealth of experience to this position. And as part of the special projects, you are working with The Inheritance. And so this is getting quite a bit of publicity on the national scene. And so I'd like to focus the rest of our segment on how did the project originate? And, you know, what are some of the goals and objectives of the project?
Well, the project originated way before I decided to join The Atlantic. The leader of the project is my boss, her name, the managing editor. Her name is Jillian White. So she actually recruited me to join the Inheritance Project. And their tagline they have on Inheritance basically is a project about American history, Black life, and the resilience of memory. And I think one of the main arguments of the project is that Black history is central to American history and that we cannot really understand our present or our future as a nation without kind of uncovering the history that has been intentionally buried. So I think the point of Inheritance is also to shine a light on Black history and like overlooked history or misunderstood history. And we also are trying to connect the past to the present. But the one thing they always emphasize, and I know my boss always emphasizes, that this is not necessarily like an educational project for, you know, white Americans. It speaks to Black readers. It's speaking to Atlantic readers. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a wide variety of voices and perspectives of Black Americans that's a part of the project.
What are some of the goals and objectives of the project?
Some of the goals is just to tell stories of ordinary Black people, not just well-known stories of historical figures of first. So, for example, our first chapter, we did a story on Eutaw, Alabama. It was by Adam Harris, and he talked about the legacy of Eutaw, Alabama, but he was able to weave in his personal history. So we're trying to tell stories that readers wouldn't expect to find. We're trying to show the diversity of, you know, Black Americans and experiences that we have and how complex our experiences and our identities are.
So is there anything, any particular stories that you're looking for?
I wouldn't say it's a particular story, but it's just the thing I always tell my writers or to writers is that if they are excited about the story or if it's something that excites them, then I'm sure that other people will also be excited. So it has to be something that would allow the writer to want to maybe work on for, you know, a couple of weeks. It has to be well-researched. And it also has to help elevate the conversation around Black American life. So it's just something that stories that kind of like move the needle, not necessarily stories that, you know, tell us what we already know. And I think one great thing about The Atlantic is they're big on introducing new ideas. So
something that you wouldn't necessarily find in like certain publications.
Are you interested in any Kentucky stories?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Of course, especially someone who's named from Kentucky. But I'm always interested in how the South End of Kentucky has changed. And like a lot of those historical schools, how they are no longer around or don't necessarily have markers. Like, I think it's like Carver School. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
Yeah, those types of stories I'm interested in. Mm-hmm.
Being in the field as long as you have, and you know, considering the success you've had as a journalist, what sort of advice would you give a young person who was interested in pursuing a career in journalism?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, because the advice varies, but I think it's being—I say for young journalists—is being rooted in who they are, and not trying to emulate other journalists, but kind of just stand a course. And I think this is I think journalism can be a tough field and you have to have a tough skin. So I think it's just developing that a third layer of toughness, but just stand a course. I mean, if this is something, if this is a field that you want to be in, I'll say just stand a course. But the other thing is just to read as much as you can, to read as many quality publications, read a diversity of writers, and just try to stay informed as possible, because you never know what opportunities can come up. You know, you may have an opportunity to do a science story for a science publication. So I would just say, just try to be informed as best as possible. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's helpful.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. We've been speaking with Ms. Janisha Watts, the Senior Editor for Special Projects for The Atlantic, and we're looking forward to reading those essays in The Inheritance. Thank you, Ms. Watts, and have a good day.
You too. Thank you.
There are 45 major lakes in Kentucky, only 3 of them natural. The rest are reservoirs. And it's what lies beneath the surfaces of those bodies of water that interested one Kentucky writer so much that she's written a book about it. And she is Tom Eblin's guest in his series on Kentucky literature.
When author Jane Moore Waldrop was growing up in Paducah, she enjoyed boating on Kentucky and Barkley Lakes and hiking in the Land Between the Lakes National Recreation Area. She didn't think much about how those places came to be. All of the families that had to leave their homes and ancestral land to make the creation of those huge federal projects possible. But she has thought a lot about it since then. The result is her first novel, Drown Town, which will be published October 26 by the University Press of Kentucky. This book explores human loss in its many forms, as well as hope and redemption. It also gives readers an interesting window into an important piece of Kentucky history that many people in other parts of the state may not be aware of. Here to talk with us about Drown Town is lawyer, poet, and now novelist Jane Moore Waldrop. Jane, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Well, first of all, could you tell our listeners what a Drown Town is and how those in Western Kentucky got to be that way?
Well, Drown Towns, that's a term that's used generally for towns that were submerged due to created lakes. You know, most of our lakes in Kentucky are man-made or created. We don't have very many natural lakes here. So all these enormous bodies of water that came to be when a river was dammed created these areas of loss when the floodwaters rose, when the rivers were dammed. So when these reservoirs filled, many towns like the old town of Eddyville and Catawba in western Kentucky were submerged. Many were deconstructed before the lakes actually filled. And like in the town of Old Catawba, it's sort of a half-drowned town. There's only a couple of streets that are left from a once bustling town in western Kentucky.
Well, so without giving away too many secrets, tell us about the plot and setting for your novel and some of the important characters.
Well, I think some of the important characters
are two women friends who have been friends since college, Cam and Margaret. They're very different. They come from different places in Kentucky. Cam is from Western Kentucky. She, her family was displaced when Lake Barkley was created in the mid-1960s. Margaret is from Louisville. She's a lawyer in Louisville. And she comes from a very privileged, affluent background. She has no idea what Western Kentucky is like. She's never been there, even though she's lived in Kentucky all of her life. So they share a friendship that goes through many decades. I wanted to show the multi-generational impact of the monumental changes to the landscape in Western Kentucky. So these two characters reflect this time. The landscape evolved during this time with the creation of the lake and the Land Between the Lakes recreation area. I have a character who is a prisoner at the Kentucky State Penitentiary during the time the lake waters are starting to rise, when the town of Eddyville is being deconstructed. I have a character who is an appraiser, who's actually doing appraisals all around the lake area and in the area known as Between the Rivers, which then became Land Between the Lakes. So I've tried to show many points of view of people who might have been affected by these monumental changes. I decided to write these stories as fiction because I liked the ability to have some as much creativity and freedom to tell these stories as possible.
We explore a lot of big themes in this book, you know, beyond this time and place with these characters. What do you hope readers will take away from this novel?
As a native Western Kentuckian, I'd like for people to understand a little more about the history of these changes. There's no question that Kentucky Dam, Barkley Dam, and the creation of Land Between the Lakes brought many benefits to Western Kentucky. There's no question that there was a need for rural electrification and navigation along the rivers to connect this area to the inland waterways. And also the benefit of having a steady stream of tourism. But these acts that most of us think were events of progress for the common good also came at a great price, a high price, and a lot of sacrifice for those who were personally affected, those who gave up their homes when these areas were taken. I don't want that history and that acknowledgement of the sacrifice to be lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were fortunate to have Silas House, the acclaimed Kentucky novelist, as your editor on this book. How did that come about?
Yes, I was.
Yes. Well, how did that come about, and how did he help you polish the book?
Well, for the last few years, I've been attending the Appalachian Writers Workshop at the Hindman Settlement School, which I think, even though I had completed an MFA in fiction writing, that my experience and what I've learned at the Appalachian Writers Workshop has really improved my writing and helped me find my voice in a different way. I think one of the benefits of going to a writer's workshop like that is to give people the confidence to find their own voice, their unique way of telling a story. So at Hindman, I have had classes with Silas House, been fortunate to have his guidance and his understanding of Kentucky literature and good fiction, no matter where that comes from. Also, Silas really understands rural people, and my story is basically about rural people in the setting. So I had a class with Silas. He asked to read my manuscript, and he recommended it for publication by University Press of Kentucky.
which is in a partnership to publish through Fireside Industries, an imprint of the University Press of Kentucky, in partnership with the Hyndman Settlement School to promote these local and Appalachian voices.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned having an MFA and taking writing classes at Hyndman, mm-hmm. but you're also a law school graduate and you practiced law for many years in Louisville and Frankfurt with a major Kentucky firm. And I'm curious how the background as a lawyer shaped you as a writer.
Well, I think writing has always been an important part of my professional life. Legal writing is very different, but it is crucial in a law practice to be able to express and communicate and advocate. So it's not that far of a leap, but I went back for my MFA because I felt that because of my years of legal writing, I had sort of lost the emotion in the writing to tell a compelling story. So I decided to pursue an MFA for that reason, to give me the guidance on how to create characters and settings that were more compelling than brief writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, having grown up in Paducah, but your family was originally from Pike County, and you spent a lot of time going back to the other end of the state. And, you know, it's Kentucky is such a different in ways. It's many different states. And what do you think people in the East and West kind of really don't understand about each other?
Well, I think just even the landscape is so different from the mountains to the very flat landscape in Western Kentucky. It's very different, but we all share such, you know, we share this state, we share a history. I'd like to think that we could do better by knowing each end of the state better and each portion of the state, you know, Central Kentucky too. I feel that there's been a lot of, I think as far as literature is concerned, there have been many more writers writing about Appalachia and Eastern Kentucky, Central Kentucky. There haven't been that many writers writing about Western Kentucky. Of course, Bobby Ann Mason changed all of that when in the early 80s with Shiloh and other stories. She became a model for me in many ways. She's a writing and literary hero to me because she made our end of the state real and read by many people all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I happen to know that Bobby Ann is a big fan of this book, so that's probably a really good recommendation to have.
Well, it's really sort of a dream come true for my book to be read by Bobby Ann and Silas House and Ron Rash, and it's been a wonderful opportunity.
Okay. Well, once again, the book is Drowned Town, coming out in October from the University Press of Kentucky. And Jane Moore Waldrop, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Ebelin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. Well, that wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett our producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.